Welcome to this podcast series on Communicating European Union Environmental Law. I'm Áine Ryle, co-director of the Centre for Law and the Environment at University College Cork. The centre is a focal point for our research, teaching and advocacy work in the field of environmental law. We're delighted to host this podcast series as part of a larger outreach project funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative. The aim of the podcast series is to explore aspects of EU environmental law in a manner that appeals to a wide audience. For this podcast, I'm joined by Jo Noonan. Jo Noonan, solicitor, is a partner in Noonan, Lenehan, Carl Coffey here in Cork. His experience and expertise in all matters relating to planning and environmental law is second to none. I've had the pleasure of knowing Jo for many years. He's a long-standing supporter of the School of Law UCC, a regular contributor to our events, and also to our environmental law teaching. In particular, Jo is a very highly regarded contributor to our LLM seminar on environmental law in practice. Thank you for joining me today, Jo.
You're very welcome, Áine. Delighted to be here.
So to start off, what sparked your own interest in planning and environmental law?
I've been thinking about that question because I kind of anticipated you might ask. And it's something that's really, I think the answer is, in a way, obvious. We're all a product of our environment. And that means both who we are and where we are when we're young and growing up. And in my case, that means in the Cork Harbour area, particularly. I was in college in UCC. I was involved in various activist groups at that time, cleaning up old car parks and picking up glass from disused graveyards and all those things. But of course, more widely in the community at that time, Cork Harbour was controversial because of the, for example, proposal to dump asbestos waste in the area of the village, hugely nationally controversial and effectively resisted by the local people. Of course, we had activities like the leak of mercaptan gas from a chemical plant in the harbour, which caused children in Monkstown School to throw up, and an explosion at another chemical plant that sent a tank several hundred feet through the air. So this has always been an area where people both understand the environment because they work within those plants and they know what works and they know what's not safe. And it's an area where people have been active and feel they can do something. And I suppose that by osmosis came through to me. But also then, specifically, I was involved in editing the Irish Anti-Nuclear Movement magazine at the time. And in 1983, just before we opened our firm in North Main Street, my partner Mary Lennon and I travelled to Scotland. And we called in at the Fast Lane Anti-Nuclear Peace Camp. And we were talking to people there, just chatting. And the first time I ever heard environmental impact assessment was in that camp. It was a new term to me in 1983. They said, we were discussing the Cairnsore nuclear plant proposals here. What about the EIA, they said. And I said, what's an EIA? So they explained to me kindly what it was. It's been part of my professional career pretty much ever since then. That's how I started. I suppose I should say our first significant environmental case was involved in the planning sought for a Swiss chemical plant, Sandoz called at the time, now Novartis, looking to establish in Enniskillen. And I argued strongly before the board in the hearing in the late 80s that the new EU directive should be applied. It had passed the 1987 trigger date. It hadn't been transposed into Irish law, so the board was not paying heed to it. I said this was unlawful. They didn't particularly take that argument at the time. That case ended up going to the Supreme Court, and in the case of Chambers versus the board, is still in the textbooks because it established a very important locus standi, the right of people to go to court in these cases. So that was where we began.
That's an absolutely fascinating account, which I think confirms, again, the depth of your experience and your expertise. And I suppose it's quite fascinating for me to hear about the new EIA directive as it was back then, and how far we've come now and how important a role EIA has played in environmental protection and indeed in litigation, followed closely now, of course, by the Habitats Directive, which really has come into its own in recent years. And following through on that point, Jo, obviously EU environmental law has had a hugely significant impact on the development of Irish planning and environmental law. And as a solicitor of your experience practicing in this area, where do you see EU environmental law having the greatest influence?
You've mentioned the Habitats Directive, Anya, and I think that's hugely front and centre in any discussion of this kind. I should probably at the institutional level add as well the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency, because I think that candidly was established in 1993 following the 1992 Act, which followed immediately after the litigation that we had brought in relation to Sandoz, highlighting the absence of statutory powers within on board Planola to examine the environmental impact. And I think there was a realization within government and the civil service that actually that was true and that something had to be done by way of an official response. And I don't think it's a coincidence that then moves were afoot immediately to establish the EPA. It has, of course, had a huge role ever since. So I think that's an institutional response. I think that in terms of impact, one has to then look at both sides of the scales, if you like, because we tend to gravitate towards the positive. Unfortunately, there are significant negatives as well, and we have to look at those. And currently, of course, and for so many years it has been current, a good example of that is the Derry Bryan wind farm construction, which led to a disastrous landslide in County Galway. And that litigation tells us a number of things, but one of the things it tells us is how slow the wheels of justice grind implementing EU law. And there are practical and procedural reasons for that, one of which is that people have a semi-detached right of access to the court, really. And the policing of EU compliance by the state is in the hands of the Commission, and the Commission itself is subject to political pressures. So for all kinds of reasons, there can be sand in the petrol and it just doesn't move. The engine doesn't move. And Derry Bryan is a pretty stark example of that. To summarise for listeners, as people will in some cases know, there was planning permission granted against advice based on assurances that it would not slide down the mountain. It did slide down the mountain. The peat loss was horrific. The damage ecologically was horrific. Ireland was taken to court by the Commission for not properly applying the relevant EU legislation to scrutinise this in advance. Ireland was found to have been in breach back in 2008, 2009, and ordered to remedy matters. They didn't remedy the matter. And ultimately, a second enforcement action was taken, seeking the court to put fines on Ireland for being in contempt of the first court order. And that came before the court, I think, in November 2019, so about 10 years later again. And the court imposed swingeing fines on Ireland, 5 million lump sum, 15,000 euros a day. The Advocate General of the court accused Ireland of engaging in a game of snakes and ladders. Such had been its switching and turning and changing its lines of defence up to the last minute. Quite astonishing language, really, in a legal context. And as we speak in 2021, the fines are continuing to mount because compliance still hasn't been achieved. The most recent effort has been condemned by the Commission as being wholly unsatisfactory. We've now run up a debt of 15 million euros, money that could be better spent. So not to dwell on that case, but it is just a stark example of failings really on every side. So while we see good things, we must also recognise the limitations, and those limitations badly need to be overcome.
Yes, Derry Bryan, unfortunately, a very stark example, as you say, that demonstrates the challenges involved in implementation and then how slowly and how long and drawn out certain controversies can be. And I suppose just to come back to significant developments in EU environmental law, we'd mentioned the Habitats Directive. As a practitioner, Joe, could you say a little to our readers about the potential power and impact of the Habitats Directive as we're seeing it unfold now?
I think the Habitats Directive has a wonderful effect on Irish judges. It really has grabbed their attention. They do get the point. And it's less nebulous in legal terms in its requirement that there should be no reasonable scientific doubt about impact on protected species or protected habitats. And that really is a simple message. And it's important when talking to lawyers about complicated technical or ecological things that you keep it simple for us, because really we need simplicity in our lives. And that goes for practitioners and for people on the bench. And so when you have that proposition, you then feel more confident in reaching an assessment, which will still be hotly contested, but at least you have a clear red line. And I guess that distinguishes the EIA from the Habitats Directives. And that's a significant point. So the Habitats Directive has anchored a lot of very good decisions. Again, not without difficulty. Numerous Court of Justice findings had to be sought. Referrals were made and reports came back saying, you have to do this, you must not do that. And that has helped shape the Irish jurisprudence, of course. But the Habitats Directive really is a bedrock of environmental protection so far as EU intervention in the Irish legal system is concerned.
Certainly. I think that's something that's going to continue into the future as the Habitats Directive comes more and more into its own. And as you said, interpreted quite robustly by the Court of Justice of the European Union, who's putting the detail on the more general bones, if you like, of the directive's provisions. And challenging too, of course, for judges, because this is difficult material. But again, the judges are embracing it and dealing with the science and dealing with the evolving law as well. So I think lots of new jurisprudence possibly to come in that particular space. Now, we touched on it to some extent already, Joe, but one question I had thought of putting to you was about the challenges involved in implementing EU environmental law. And you'd mentioned Derry Brine as a particularly stark example. But in terms of more specifics, I suppose, do you see some other challenges there? And if there are, how you might see them being resolved in a general way?
Yeah, there are challenges. And costs, of course, is a significant challenge in bringing High Court litigation because our system requires that it A, be brought in the High Court, so very expensive from day one, and B, be brought typically by way of judicial review, which is a very difficult form of legal proceeding to bring, imposing exceptionally tight time limits, 8 weeks to bring a case, which is unheard of in practically any other area of law. And you must document and vouch all of your case in writing within that 8 week period. And you may be dealing with five boxes of technical material on which the decision has been made. And to synthesize that, to engage in brief counsel and to get the argument hammered into shape on the anvil with counsel to present to court within that 8 week period, it's phenomenal that any cases are brought at all. So then you have the cost burden on top of that, the risk that people may have if they are engaging lawyers or if they are told, if you lose this case, you are at some risk. The good thing, I suppose, of course, is that as a result of initiatives like the UNECE Aarhus Convention, mediated through the EU, but also directly, the government has recognized that you cannot put people at risk of losing their home if they lose an environmental case brought in the public interest. So there is now a degree of protection for people against that happening. But it's interesting now again to look at the other side of that, because currently there are moves afoot at high level to apparently make it more difficult again for people to go to court, to restrict the ability of people to ask a judge to look at the lawfulness of a decision that will have huge implications. And a disturbing challenge, I think we can fairly call it now, that we see in recent months is the increasing tendency at a high level politically, including in government, unfortunately, to lambaste publicly people who do look to challenge a decision that may turn out to be unlawful. That's something that traditionally in Ireland didn't happen. We had a very good and wise, I think, and appropriate respect, I suppose, for people engaging in the legal process. Certainly, I know my advice to my clients when embarking on a case, no matter how controversial it is, you do not talk about this case until it's over. And then you either indicate that you're disappointed or you're happy. But you do not engage in an American-style public bashing of your opponent or tub thumping that you're right and they're wrong. Unfortunately, we seem to have a little bit lost that focus at a high level here now, when we have a current case which the Supreme Court has just declared is important. There is an issue that needs to be ventilated to do with the cheese factory in Kilkenny. And there has been quite extraordinary outpourings of criticism that this is an abusive process, which is extraordinary. The Supreme Court says this is an important legal point, we need to make a decision on it. And you have people really who should better, I think, consider what they say before they rush to print. So that's a challenge. And I suppose to tie that into Aarhus, of course, there is a requirement in Aarhus that the member states, including Ireland, should take steps to protect people from harassment or from victimization who go to court or who seek to exercise their rights of participation and so on. And it's remarkable to the extent that a High Court judge has recently felt it necessary to draw the attention, indeed, of government to the provision. So we're into a kind of a rocky enough area there now. And I think I would plead that people would just draw back a little bit, lower the temperature, remember the value of discretion and respect. We've seen what culture wars can do in other places. And really, this is a moment for us to think about whether we want to just go back to the area of waiting participating in the legal process and then dealing with the consequences in a sensible manner when the process is over.
Yes, and I always enjoy, of course, when our contributors mention the Aarhus Convention, which is obviously something very close to my own heart. And as you say correctly, of course, Joe, mediated through European Union environmental law in the Irish context. And I think you've touched on there so many live issues, really, about the importance of access to justice, the challenges involved in engaging in judicial review proceedings. And you mentioned, of course, some interesting current developments as well. We do see globally a very serious issue around the position of environmental defenders. And that plays out in different ways in different jurisdictions. But again, I think very significant, as you say, that a High Court judge felt it necessary to mention Article 3.8 of the Aarhus Convention. Just again, something I think that we all need to be very aware of, and the importance of protecting the rights of environmental defenders more generally. With a view to pulling our conversation towards some conclusion, I suppose I was also keen to ask you, Joe, given your experience, the area in which you work, and your engagement with a wide range of people, be it individuals, groups and others, would you say that there's a good level of awareness out there of environmental law rights, if I can call them that, amongst the public? What would be your sense of the situation?
In terms of awareness of environmental law rights among the public, the picture is mixed and it varies with location, among other things. I mentioned Cork Harbour, which is an area that I would describe as being very well tuned into aspects of planning environmental law and participating in the process of developing the county development plan. National policy consultation processes are always engaged with, and all of those things are very well understood. The difficulty in terms of public awareness is that, and again, this can be how the organs of state portray the role of the legal system and the citizen engaging the legal system. Because in the past week, I have seen on my television screen, unfortunately, a person holding junior ministerial office appearing to suggest that going to court really was an exercise in trying to trip him up. It was almost a personal insult, he felt, that somebody who was identifying what on the face of it appeared to be a serious legal flaw in what was being done in a certain part of the country, without regard to the Habitats Directive, perhaps, was somehow a kind of a mousetrap exercise. That's an entirely inappropriate, I think, analysis. And I think it's an unsophisticated analysis. It's an act of populism, candidly. And I think we really need to be careful, because there's a famous speech back in literature where Thomas More, I think, asks his interlocutor, would you cut down all the trees in England to chase the devil? And the guy says, of course I would. And then the obvious answer is, well, when you do that, and when all the trees are down, and when the storm comes, where do you shelter? We have these laws, not just to protect people we don't agree with, but also to protect ourselves. And I think in fairness to people who want to promote development and people who want to finance development, they're equally entitled to certainty and they're entitled to expedition. And I suppose my comment on this would be, there is currently planned a review of planning law. I think there are very simple steps that can be taken to benefit everybody, to eliminate delays in the process and to get better decisions quickly and to have any assessment of them legally dealt with in a good, fast way. And those are three. One, give proper resources to the local authorities in their planning offices and on board Planola, because they're completely overburdened. So let them out from under that pressure. Secondly, make people who make decisions, local authority, board Planola, comply with the same tight time limits that apply to people who are looking to bring judicial review proceedings, because I mentioned the 8-week limit earlier. There's no equivalent limit for response time for filing papers by the decision maker. And that can lead to delays of up to a year before you get to the next stage of the case. So apply the same time limits to both sides in the courtroom. And thirdly, of course, we're notoriously under-resourced when it comes to our judiciary, the lowest pro rata in the OECD. So we need to have a serious look at appointing more judges at the appropriate level and resourcing the judges that we have at the moment. There are too many courts where a judge has to sit all weekdays hearing cases and has no time to write his or her judgment. So that has to be addressed. These are very practical things. They could be implemented very quickly, I think, in fact, without significant legal changes. And they would transform the process, which is a controversial process at times, to the benefit of people who are trying to promote development and to the benefit of people who are looking to have questionable decisions assessed, and ultimately to the benefit of the environment.
Well, I think that's a very powerful point, or set of points on which to finish, Joe, in particular the need for legal certainty for all sides in this, and the importance for everybody of high quality decision making and then efficient review procedures where that is necessary. And those basics, I think, sometimes are often overlooked. And again, it's just important that we have an informed, sensible, calm debate about these things and not just rush into something that might simply end up making things worse. On that note, I think it's appropriate to wrap up. So thank you, Joe Noonan, for joining us and providing those fascinating insights from your practical experience.
Thank you very much, Anya.